Wow, I can almost feel the anticipation. Well, I hope nobody's thinking that this is like highlight of the conference or anything like that. This is just a bunch of crazy stuff. Crazy, I tell you. I'm kind of glad I'm gone before the Sidwell guy. There he is. Are you up tomorrow?
I didn't
want to have to sit through that and then come up here, because that would have been embarrassing. This is a time to just sit back in the grass and close your eyes, stare at the sky, then close your eyes again, and dream of the GIS, perfect GIS. That's what we're trying to do. Whether it's going to work or not, I have no idea, but I sure hope so. So, this is aptly named Concocting a GIS, because this is just some kind of concoction that we've been sitting around just trying to brainstorm and play with it and see if it turns into anything. If it does, it could turn out to be pretty neat. If it doesn't, well, I guess maybe it's a colossal waste of time. So, who knows? Maybe we'll find out one day. But what we want to do here is design a geodatabase that's optimized for data maintenance and map production. We see a lot of products out there that do this with GIS data and do that with GIS data, but I'll get into that. We'll get there. Just some quick background. Well, this probably won't be quick, but you need some background. Starting out with an introduction kind of to how big a place Kern County is. Jeff showed a little bit of this morning. But if you look at some of these numbers, you'll see we're right on the heels of Los Angeles. We have about 750,000 residents here, almost 8,200 square miles, over 5 million acres of land. We've got 11 incorporated cities, Bakersfield being the county seat, and probably having at least half, maybe two-thirds of the population in the one city. Our most recent tax roll went out at just under $1 billion. We're currently modeling about 390,000 parcels. We maintain over 16,000 map pages. You'll see the sadness that follows. Only 2,700 of those are converted to AutoCAD. We have a long ways to go. But these are the kinds of numbers that made us realize that we need to do something different than what we're doing now. And we're doing this, when you see the projected growth we have here, I don't plan on being around that long, so maybe another 10 or 15 years. We're doing all this with just 5 people. Our current mapping system, for now, is getting the job done. But it really has not much more room for expansion. We use AutoCAD Map 2004. We have 2005, 2006, and 2007 all sitting in the boxes. But the thing is, none of those new versions really added any functionality that was of any use to us. There's some pretty great things in there for architects and engineers and people that do map sheets and insert all these fancy tables and do bills of material and all that, but has no use for us. So we use AutoCAD. Mac product particularly because it allows importing and exporting of shapefiles, basically. We use it for data creation, we use it for data editing, and we use it to publish the actual, you know, plot out the assessor data. And we keep a single map page in a single DWG file. So you accumulate all these thousands of files. We also use ArcInfo. We have one ArcInfo license and four Arc editors. This is kind of how we, what we hope to use in the future. Although some of the Arc editor licenses are now possibly coming into question as to whether they'll be adequate. We do have a single shapefile that contains all the land parcels, all those 390,000 I mentioned earlier, but it's only the land surface parcels only, well, and condominiums. We still would like to do like mineral rights parcels, but that's just one more thing that would add more time to our, you know, our workload. And it's just not going to happen right now with this system, I don't think. But we share this shapefile. That's what we share with the world. We post it on our website. You can download it for free. All you will miss is getting the owner's names. But you can read the metadata file, and that will tell you how to call me up and order a complete CD-ROM with everything on it for $80. And the only reason it's $80 is because that was an existing fee that they didn't have to go to the Board of Supervisors to ask for a new fee. It's called an information fee. And they typically use it for, like, querying the tax roll and giving somebody a eBase file, for instance. So they just lump our stuff in with that. And of course, we do occasionally some special projects with it ourselves. So we do a little bit of GIS analysis here and there, a couple times a year. Of course, our current mapping system has problems, or we wouldn't be trying to find out where the grass is greener. The biggest problem is that we're maintaining two different data sets. We have all these CAD files, and we have this GIS shapefile, and they don't always match. There's various reasons for that, partly because the drafters tend to want to try to get their work done faster, so they don't always make sure that everything is exactly the same in both data sets, but that's what you get when you try to maintain two different data sets. It's never going to work. The CAD data is also not always georeferenced. These days, now we try to locate it in real coordinates space. A lot of the older CAD files are just sitting at 0, 0. So it's really inconsistent also. And since we basically maintain not only the parcel layer, but we also the TRA layer we get from the state board in a CAD file, we kind of convert that into a GIS format. But then by the end of the year, the parcels have all adjusted, and that TRA file's never moved, so now they're not coincident anymore. And we've heard that from several others here today, that kind of thing happens. Our system has been fairly difficult to administer. The heavier the workload, the more obvious these things become. Trying to keep the GIS caught up, well, that's my job. But I'm one guy, and then there's four others that are constantly tossing work at me. Well, if they're doing tracks, it's not so bad, because it takes them longer to do a track, so I may get one file a day. But if they're sitting around doing plot line adjustments where they're cranking out four or five of them a day, then I'm Whoa, wait up, guys. So that's why if you call me around June, I'm a busy guy because I'm trying to get caught up in all this backlog. As I mentioned earlier, trying to keep track of all those thousands of CAD files. And if you have thousands of files on a server, it's inevitable. Some of them are going to get lost. Some of them are going to get deleted. Some of them are going to get corrupted. It just happens. Server dies, and you know, takes half a dozen files with it. It's become too difficult to maintain all the GIS layers that we want to do. You know, I mentioned mineral rights parcels. Our hands are full just doing what we're doing now. Unless things start slowing down. And that also makes it difficult to release the data for, you know, people that want to use it. So there's a certain number of or a certain amount of data that we like to present on an assessor map that makes it useful and meaningful to, you know, to not only the appraisers but the outside world. You know, like if we try to put out a map with no dimensions on it, we're going to get phone calls all day long. Maybe not so much if you direct them to the website and say, well, you can measure it on the website, as you saw earlier with the measuring tool. But you still have to field that phone call and direct them to the website and tell them, and then tell them how to use it. So, but you need a certain amount of data to make a meaningful map. Now, and this is just some of them. I'm sure I didn't dream up all of them, you know, just coming up with this slide, but this is probably the minimum. So there may be some more. And we actually draw all this stuff right now in AutoCAD. You know, this is just some of the stuff that we pull off of the track map or the parcel map or the deed. And if the map needs to show it, then we draw it. Regardless of whether the engineering department draws it already in some of their own files or, you know, if they draw it, it'd be one thing if they would draw it and then share it with us and draw it before we need it. You know, that kind of stuff doesn't always happen. So we basically maintain, or try to maintain, all this different types of data, or what you might consider layers in a GIS, we tend to try to do all that ourselves. Now, there are two layers that are created in the engineering department. The guy you met earlier, Jeff, did a pretty good job of creating a section layer for us when he first came on about 5 years ago. And we went ahead and once he finished that, which he did in about 6 months, so most of it was pretty good. But a lot of it where there were gaps, he filled in with GCDB, BLM section data. And then, of course, there's a certain amount of typo errors in there. So, you know, that's to be expected. But the first thing we did was decide, okay, we already have this parcel fabric. We had to figure out, okay, well, obviously, and of course, it doesn't match up or register very well to the section layer. So we actually embarked on an in-house project where we basically rubber sheeted everything in the county to fit those section corners. And it turned out pretty good. There's problems here and there. As we encounter them, we fix them. The problem is the engineering department also maintains a street centerline file, which we would love to use for additional control inside the sections, but that layer kind of got absconded by the E911 system, so it ended up to where they ended up optimizing that file for routing because they want a fire truck to go here. And, well, you know, you can't make a fire truck go across a median in the middle of a highway. So rather than one single center line for a freeway, they put in two lines going like opposite directions. And there's other oddities and interesting things in the file as well that render it pretty well useless for mapping purposes. Like, what, you know, if we were to want to offset those center lines to create the rights of way, we can't do it. Here's an example. Also, you'll notice we adjusted our parcels to the sections, but they never got around to adjusting the street centerline file to fit those same sections. It doesn't really matter to them because all they want is for a fire truck to get to Joe's house and put out fire. It doesn't matter to them that it's, you know, maybe 60 or 50 feet off. I really don't even think they're using GPS in the vehicles yet. But even if they were, you know, you can pretty much tell on the screen what road that truck is on, even if it's off. So I don't know when this file will ever get fixed, but you'll notice that there's other problems as well. Since they want to do routing and they want the computers to have good performance, they did things like take the curves out and replace them with these long segments. So it's been optimized for a single purpose, and we can't really do much with it, other than put it on the screen and label the streets. And most of the time, they come up in a pretty close spot. We've looked at several other possibilities. We've looked at the parcel data model that you can download from the ESRI website. We've seen Vascular Editor demos. We've seen the Sidwell demo, or I have anyway. And then there's another product out there that's similar to Sidwell, which was formerly known as the Novalis Parcel Editor, but got bought out by this ACS company. And I presume, as far as I know, they're still maintaining and marketing that. I've never actually seen that one, but really, as we look at these kinds of products, we start to notice patterns that develop. The product is either too complex or too specialized or too far-reaching. Like some of them try to infiltrate your entire assessor's office and make this big, fully integrated system. Well, I guess we're just not ready for that yet. And I understand you can buy just, in some of them you can buy just the parcel editing part of it. But even then, that part, a lot of times, fits in some of these other categories. At this point, I wouldn't say that we're closed-minded about looking at any of them again at any time to see if they will meet our needs. But at this point, we've invested ourselves and we have this crazy scheme in our head. And so we're just trying to follow it out and see where it goes. Like the parcel data model from ESRI, fantastic job, great model. But you know what? If we tried to model all that stuff in separate feature classes like that, you're going to run into a lot of those problems that we talked about before. ESRI's answer to that is, well, okay, we'll give you this topology editing toolbar where you can create a map topology, I think it is. I could be wrong there, but you can drag one node to a new location and it'll carry every other underlying feature type along with it. Well, that's great, but you don't always edit your data by editing nodes. If you had to sit there and edit an entire feature class or a whole track or something, going to take you forever to drag all those notes. So it just doesn't seem very efficient to us. Bottom line is, most of these things, or maybe at least the way they've been presented to us, just don't seem to work the way we want it to work. So here's what we want. We want something that's non-proprietary. We want the freedom to modify and extend this thing. You know, whatever it is we end up with, we prefer to be able to change it if we want to make it work in a slightly different way. Because things don't always work exactly the way you want them, but with third-party products, that you generally buy the product and that's what you get. They own the rights to the code. And you're prohibited from reverse engineering it or doing anything like that. So, problem. We want something flexible, generic. We figure we're simply maintaining data, and then we're trying to make maps with that data. So we figure, and we've seen several other systems, like I can pick on Santa Cruz because school is not here. It looks like a pretty fantastic little system. It's fairly simplistic. There's not a lot of complexity to it. But there's this thing about it seems to be optimized for only making one type of map, an assessor map. Well, we want to be able to make any kind of map, assessor map, a tax rate area map, an assessor book index map, you know, there's or whatever else we might be called upon to try to make. So we figure the more generic the system, or at least the data part of it, and we can build in intelligence later to do things like build whatever kind of map we want. We want a system that's automated. We want to use the computer or leverage the computer's power to do what the computer is good at, then leave the drafting part of it or the map, you know, the data, manipulating data part to the user. And you'll kind of see what I mean by that later on. To automate it, though, you have to come up with a schema or a design that is data-driven, because the computer will only do what you tell it to do or what you've defined for it to do. So you have to store those definitions somewhere. And we think the geodatabase offers a reasonable place to do that. And we want a system that's consistent. We don't want something that has all these special cases. Well, you have to do this if you want this kind of thing, or you have to do that if you want that kind of thing. We want the data to be consistent. We want the schema to be consistent. And we want the procedures to use it to be consistent. We want this thing to be simple to use. That's another thing that we've noticed in some of the third-party products is one of the first things they do is pop open this big, huge dialog box with five tabs across the top. And every tab is covered with all these options and settings and tolerances and gizmos and whirlywigs. So we'd like to try to avoid that kind of thing, too. But the price to pay for a system that's easy to use, you know, well, are we asking for too much? Probably, maybe, I don't know yet. We don't think so, but the price to pay for a system that's easy on the front end is something that takes a little more complexity on the back end. And that means custom programming. Now we think that this custom programming doesn't even have to be particularly difficult. It just has to do some very simple things that are not exactly built into the for our GIS product. You know, of course, thank the guys for giving us the Visual Basic, you know, the ability to go in and program it in Visual Basic for .NET, for C#, or whatever, pick your language. You can do that because of ARC objects, the underlying pieces to the puzzle. So, but, you know, that's the price, is you have to learn how to program ARC objects. It's not the easiest thing in the world. If any of you have tried it, maybe some of you, like Ted, is probably an expert at it. But I'm not. I'm a mapper, and I program out of necessity. So, oh, how did you get in there? That's our, we've come up with a kind of a prototype working product. You know, we're kind of developing this thing as we go. And this is what it looks like so far in the geo database, in our catalog. Well, I don't mean him, I mean the, I know those are kind of hard to read over there, but basically you've got one feature data set, and that contains a bunch of stuff, you know, some feature classes and some relationship classes, and then you have some standalone tables there at the bottom. But you'll see a little more about that in the upcoming slides. This will be kind of nuts and bolts, so if you guys don't feel comfortable with looking at a bunch of database stuff, well, sorry, but sorry for you. That's pretty much what this is. I mean, GIS is a database, so we figured that out a while back. If you're wanting to get into GIS but don't want to get into the database, well, you've got a conflict of interest there. So here's the basic system specs. We want to model all the features as line segments and arcs. We want to have this big master feature class that's nothing but lines and arcs. Now, it's a single feature class. Each line feature is drawn only once, and that's the maintenance part of it. I know everybody in here likes the idea of if there's a line there, you draw the line one time, and then you never have to draw it again. And really, the computer may not even have to ever draw it again. It will. So what we want to do is, the thing is, when you draw one line, that line can represent many different things that happen to coincide at that location. You can have a parcel line that also functions as a subdivision boundary, that also functions as a street right-of-way, and you know, it could go on and on. It could be any number of things, right? But what we do in the assessor maps, we kind of pick one and we rank them and we say, well, okay, but if it's a subdivision boundary, that takes precedence. We want that to appear darker on the assessor map because we want to be able to see it as a subdivision boundary or whatever the case might be. So what we're going to do is try to tag each line as one or more feature types. Now we're going to do this with database tables. We're going to use some topology, but when you're talking about line feature class, you're talking about very simple topology rules that basically only try to keep the endpoints connected. Because our end goal is to be able to generate polygons later on. To do that, you need everything connected. You need clean line work. So the attributes then are going to have to come from someplace else. I remember that I'm not real familiar with the old coverages, but I seem to recall that, well, if you drew a line in a coverage and you wanted to model parcels, you had to tell that, you had to attribute that line for which ATN was on the left side and which ATN was on the right side, or something like that. Well, our our NAD scheme is a little bit different than that. We just want to put the attributes in points, because there's a tool in our info that will let us marry the two later on and generate polygons. So you have lines and points and a tool that will generate polygons as you need them. And then finally, the last piece of the puzzle here is that the maps will be generated automatically or maybe semi-automatically, depending on how much of it we can actually get into an automated fashion. And even the maps will be generated as they're needed. This will avoid having folders of thousands of MXD files. You won't need that. And we wouldn't want that anyway, because after all, I don't know if some of you that have been around for a while using AutoCAD, you have all these DWGs sitting around, and you started creating those maybe back in release 14, and now you're using 2007. Well, then one day you open one up and it's, it's still an old R14 file. You say to yourself, gee, wouldn't it be nice to upgrade all these files to the latest release? Well, when you count how many files there are, and then put a guy on it for a week. Well, you know, that's the kind of thing that happens if you try to maintain all these separate files. It just starts getting crazy. So we'd rather just be able to open up an ArcMap document and then follow a procedure or run a tool or whatever it ends up being that says, oh, you want to make a map? What kind of map? Oh, an assessor map? Okay, what booking page do you want? Depending on what you type in, then the computer will leverage its power and start looking things up. It'll look up all these definitions that you've previously created for how to make that map. Weird. So here's the nuts and bolts beginning. This is the basic logical design of what we think might be the system that we're after. And so you can see we have the geometry, which is all just simple lines, and every feature class has its own attribute table. Okay, well, I guess you could, if you had a finite number of feature types that you were trying to model, you could just keep adding fields to the attribute table and say, is it a parcel line? Yes or no. Is it a street right-of-way line? Yes or no. That's, you know, we don't want to go there. Why do that when we have these magical things called relational databases? So we created this little series of standalone tables. They're basically standalone because there's no geometry associated with them. And they're very simple. As you can see, there's only two fields. And the first field is the object ID of the very record in the field, in that table. The second, this feature ID, is basically that object ID. So you have the line and its identifier. And if you want certain number of lines to be parcel boundaries, then you store those feature IDs in the parcel land tag table. And then it's the mere existence of a record here tells you that that's the line you want to go back and get. And in the geodatabase, we have these other things that you have to use to link things up, and that's these feature or relationship classes. And even the relationship classes are very simple. In fact, I think that I created them by accepting all the defaults in the wizard. There's a create relationship class wizard that goes through about half a dozen screens. And I accepted the defaults on every one of them except for one, and that's where you tell it the name of that future ID field. You just tell it which two fields you want to link. So there's nothing extraordinarily or even remotely difficult about this. It's probably the most simple use of the features. But hopefully you'll see the potential of it as we go on. So once those tables are set up and you're back in ArcMap, here's kind of how you would go about applying those tags to the features. What you basically do is you start by selecting the geometry that you want to share common feature tags. And then you start an editing session. And then you open the attribute editing tool, which is found on the editing toolbar. Now, I don't know, most ArcGIS users are familiar with that attribute editing tool. Some people just open the table straight from the layer, and you can edit the values in the table, in the attribute table, that way. But you have to use this tool if you want to edit items in a related table. Okay? So by going through this way, you can actually edit or add new records into those related tables, even though they're not in the attribute table itself. So you might notice and this is how you do it. You just, these numbers under the master layer, those represent the object ID of the feature. And then as you go down, you'll see all the related tables, the names of the related tables. You just right-click on the table name and say Add New, and it'll add a new record. And the magic of the related relational database is that object ID will automatically appear in the feature ID of the related table. So all you just click on Add New, and it's over. You just tag the feature. But you might notice that if you select very many features, you've got a lot of right-clicking to do. So that's why we call this the hard way. But at least it can be done without custom programming. But this is what you have to go through to do. So once you've clicked Add New, then this is what the same screen will look like. Now you see the feature ID added over in the right pane of the editor. But that's just one feature. Like I said, you've got to go through all the features and all the tags that you want to apply. So it's a lot of right-clicking if you want to do a lot of them at once. Now, to do the reverse of tagging means now you want to extract a feature type, a certain feature type, like say parcel lines. I want to generate polygons, but I've got all these different lines in there that represent all these different things, and I got these points that I have my attributes on. And if I want to generate polygons, I have to extract just the lines that represent parcels. There's going to be a lot of other lines in there too that don't necessarily represent parcels. This part is actually easier than the first part, easier than tagging. All you do is you load in the tag table that you want that represents the feature that you want to extract. Open its attribute table, go to the Options button, and hit Select All. You want all the parcels. And I can't think of a time when you'd ever want anything less than all the parcels, but it'd be pretty hard to query anything based on just a bunch of feature IDs anyway. So This is just a step I have to get out of the way. And then step two is you go back to the options button again and come up to the related tables item. That will show you all the relationship classes that exist on that table. You just put, and there's only going to be one because this is a one-to-one relationship. So you just click that guy and your features are all going to highlight themselves. We keep asking ourselves why, if they're related by a relationship class in the geodatabase, when you select everything in that related table, why don't the features just highlight automatically? I don't know. Ask those guys. Okay, so let's look at tagging features the easy way. Instead of doing all that right-clicking, this is where we write our custom program. We write it one time and then it's done. Or at least until the Esri guys come out with a new product that it won't work in any longer. Then you have to rewrite your code or refactor the code or do whatever you have to do to make it work. You have to make it work in .NET 6.0 or whatever. Okay, but like I said, hopefully this programming isn't going to be that complicated. Once it's written, I mean, I'm not really much of a programmer, but I can look at other people's programs and figure out how they work. Okay, so I think once this thing is written, as long as I work there anyway, I can go into the code and look at it and probably figure out how to change it to make it work if I need to. Or even how to extend it or make it work differently. Because basically what I'm stuck on is the logic behind how the code works. So all we have is a very simple form done in Visual Basic. It has one list box on it. And I'm showing four buttons at the bottom. The number of buttons may end up changing or varying, but these are kind of the basic. This is basic functionality here. This is our prototype. And you'll also notice there's another table over there on the right. In order for the tool to work, the tool needs to know some other information that we haven't already given it. Like the tool would not know which tag table to go to get a certain kind of a feature. So this is a definition table that tells the tool where to go, which table to go to get which kind of feature. You can see this is even pretty simple itself, only four fields. You have the object ID, which is, you know, means nothing. It's just an identifier for a record. Then you have feature type, which is kind of a friendly name for what you see in that list box. Then you have the table name. That's where the tool finds out what table to go to get parcels. And we have the subtype name. And this is this is how we define, depending on what kind of feature it is, we may want it to participate in a different topology. So it gets the subtype name depending on what subtype to use, depends on what kind of feature it is. So very simple definition table. Once again, this is hardly rocket science, but it's just different. So here's how the tagging tool works. Nothing extraordinarily difficult here either. Just a bunch of lines. As you can see over here, it gets the friendly names to fill up the list box from this field here. Then copies the subtype. Depending on which feature type this is, it copies the subtype name into the attribute table. And of course, it's looking up the correct table names. And then it copies the object ID from the attribute table into the appropriate tag tables. That's it. Real simple, huh? Okay, so applying tax then might look something like this. You click a button on your toolbar, and our little magic tool pops open, and you can select your features, and you can select any number of tag types, and the program is going to do the hard work. It's going to do the rest. It's going to do all that right-clicking behind the scenes. Since we don't like to do right-clicking, make the computer do it. So, and there's a common problem solved here. If you ever move the parcel line and it no longer aligned with the TRA line, everything getting out of coincidence. Well, by modeling line segments that don't overlap, this is basically not possible. It can't happen if, as long as you extract all your different feature classes out of the same set of lines, everything by default, by definition, has to line up because it's the same lines. So that's kind of the beauty of this kind of system. And by the way, I'm giving the Sidwell guy a pick on him, but this whole thing is kind of inspired by the Sidwell product, so I will say that. Thank you. You're welcome. Now, when it comes time to generate polygons, all we need is two things, points and lines. We just need the right lines for the parcels, or for the subdivision boundaries, or whatever other kind of polygon you want. So, that's it. That's the only two layers we need to do that. And then, of course, we need the tool, which is in the toolbox. But it's only in ArcInfo, unfortunately. Here again, in Esri's infinite wisdom, they gave us ArcEditor, which has this tool on a toolbar called Construct Features. Well, that makes us have to go select the line work in the map, and then click on the tool, and it'll create polygons and put them in another feature class. Okay, fine and good, but then they give you this nifty tool here, which kind of works automatically on an entire feature class, but they only give you that in ArcInfo. Go figure. So all you do is, real simple, tell it the master layer name to input, and check this box for preserve attributes, and you give it the name of the point feature class, because that's where it's going to get its attributes from. You click OK, and it works. It goes, and you come out with polygons on the other side. And you can tell, you can name it whatever you want. So, basically, then when it comes time to generate a map, this is the part of the process that we have dealt with the least, because this is kind of down the road. We haven't really gotten there yet. But we know certain things that are going to have to happen. We can foresee these things, that there's going to be some queries involved. We're going to only need certain types of line features. We may need certain, you know, like I said, those certain feature classes that you need to display on the map, the different features that you want to show on the map. Well, you need a feature class for every one of those. Now, you'll learn with the Sidwell product that this can be handled other ways. And actually, we're kind of handling it. It can be done kind of two different ways. You can either, see the problem is, when you put, if you want to symbolize something, you realize you have to have something in the attribute table on which that you can categorize it, where you have to say, okay, anything with this attribute, I want it symbolized this way, or if it has a different value, I want it symbolized this way. Kind of like your roads, if you want to show the freeways with a darker line and the arterials with a little bit lesser line, and then all the way down the locals or dirt roads with a dashed line, maybe. Well, you have to have a field in the attribute table that classifies those different types. Well, we kind of foreseeing this, that we may need a field in the attribute table to handle that, but the value in that field is not going to be permanent because it's going to be based on what kind of map we're using at the time. So we kind of foresee another programming tool and some more tables in the geodatabase that define each type of map and what, and like the books and pages and all that, so that the tool can go look up what it needs in order to fill in the symbology field in the attribute table. If that doesn't make sense, don't worry about it. But we know there's going to be queries and maybe definition queries involved. We're going to need certain line features, we're going to need certain annotation features, which will probably come out of annotation feature classes. But if you're only modeling one map book page, then you only need a certain subset of features to fit on that page. So that's where queries come in. We also know we're going to need some geoprocessing models, because we're going to have to generate certain amount of polygons. We're going to have to extract certain line feature classes, because everything needs to be symbolized for a specific type of map. And dare I say, even for, if it's the same type of map, even for different scales, because not every map, every accessory map is not the same scale. And your line weights may change depending on the scale, even. So all of that stuff has to be defined somewhere, but we think it's possible to define that stuff all in database tables. It's just a matter of figuring out how. So, and of course, the reference tables, which I mentioned, that will hold definitions for feature symbology and layout elements. That's layout elements. Once you get all the data symbolized the way you want, now you click on the layout button, and you have a map title, north arrow, scale bar, and all that cool stuff. Well, we kind of think that stuff can be defined in the table too. So, why not? Maybe even have another programming tool that works once the drafter sets up the map page and sets up the layout the way he wants it. Then maybe you click on a tool and it collects all the information about that layout and stores that stuff in the table. So you set it up one time, click a button, stores it all away, and then you can do it again to make that same map later, real easily, just by recalling what you stored. So, like I said earlier, this generating maps process has not been defined yet. It'll probably be the most challenging part of this whole thing. But here again, when we saw firsthand what Santa Cruz County was doing, it kind of told us that all this stuff that we're looking at here is probably possible. So we kind of feel like we want to explore it and find out. But we need to nail down a good working prototype first, which takes time. And time is a luxury we have very little of right now because of all this work. None of you know what that's like, I'm sure. But the generic data structure, we think, should lend itself to any map publishing requirements. Our engineering department right now has us involved in this little data sharing loop where they draw the subdivision boundary and they send it. They send us the boundary and the street center lines And then we're supposed to take that, fill in the lot lines, and then send it back so that they can keep track of the lot lines on their case maps. That all seems like a waste of time to me, but we do it because we like Jeff. So that you know, those subdivision boundaries is something that if they didn't draw them, we're going to draw them anyway. So, you know, what's the point? It's like, why can't they just wait on us to draw it? And then once we draw it, not only are they going to get it back, but it's going to match up perfectly to the parcels. So, and it's going to match up perfectly to everything else. So, where are we now? Right now, today, we have a parcel polygon shape file. It's pretty well aligned with the section corners, although Jeff has identified quite a few corners that are going to need to be fixed and adjusted because of errors and other things. We have our little prototype file geodatabase that we're working with right now. As soon as Jeff upgrades all of his stuff to ArcGIS server, and we plan to use that SDE. We plan to use his license of server for our SDE connection. So we can't really set anything up in an SDE database until Jeff gets his ducks in a row. So we're kind of waiting on him. We also need to add some line work for features other than parcels. Well, like I said, our shapefile right now is parcel lines. We don't have no street center lines or anything else in there. All that line work is going to take some time to put in, but I guess that'll be our next big, you know, as we go kind of thing. We need to program the basic tagging tool that you saw earlier. And that's really kind of the heart of the whole system. I think if we can get that little piece done, then we can really start going to town with our prototype and maybe accelerate the development of the other pieces of this thing. We need to really sit down and define the subtypes and topology rules. We don't think that's going to be a big deal because we're only dealing with lines. I've identified maybe four topology rules that that we may have to use. And the nice thing is there can be construction lines in there too, lines that you just draw in there to help you create other things that are otherwise meaningless. Well, those don't have to participate in any topology. If you don't tag them, they don't go into the topology. Because the tool is what does that. And you have to use the tool to tag things. But if you don't tag anything, it's just a construction line. So we need to design the map generation procedures. That's what I perceive is going to be the hardest part because there's going to be so much to it. But I do think it's going to be possible, I tell you. We just need some more time. We need a good slowdown in the development around here to get off our backs. So hopefully Sunday we'll be able to flip a big switch and have a working GIS. And God knows what will happen when we do it.
Hierarchical topology, and it's built into their basis of the 10G system and their new 11 system coming out, it does everything that you're talking about. Out of the box, I mean, there's some programming, there's some code, stuff like that, but all the hooks, everything that you need to do that you're talking about exists currently in the technology.
I'm not plagiarizing, am I?
No. You're one head step ahead of most people, I think it is.
Thank you. I wouldn't find, you know, I'm game to look at any kind of product out there that may already do this kind of thing. If it means the difference between sitting down and spending all this time, or sitting down and trying to convince our bosses to pay for it, you know, which is worse, I don't know. But you know, it's just been my experience that with third-party products, you usually end up with those kind of problems I mentioned earlier. But you know, we're really trying to keep an open mind. I'd love to see any kind of literature about a product out here that's even close to something like this. Like I said, this is inspired by the Sidwell thing. They were bold enough to put these white papers on their website that shows their whole schema. It shows all their table structures and everything. You know, of course, the heart of the system is the program. So I suppose that's why they don't mind doing that, because you're not going to get anywhere with it without the program. Well, you know, obviously we showed that you can, but it's not going to be a very fun system to use if you don't have to. But it's possible, you know. If you install the new version and it breaks and the tool doesn't work, at least the guys can still work. So, you know, that's just the kind of thing that it's nice to know that the it's nice to know that the whole system is completely dependent on this. You know, it can be done in more than one way. Yeah, I'm willing to look at anything. Any other questions? Comment?
Actually, I think I cut him off. If you have any more questions, can I interrupt him and cut him off for now? If you have any more questions, you can ask him afterwards. Yeah, and we're just saving some time for discussion. We only have about 20 minutes of that left. But Fred has something he wanted to go over.
Yeah.
We got it. You said you had something you wanted to discuss during this time.
No, go ahead. Something real quick here.
Yes. I just kind of want to know how
other offices are
handling something like this. Basically, as far as getting grant deeds that reference legal scriptures from lot line adjustments. And I'm wondering, is that, like, for instance, a lot line adjustment might say, use parcel A, and they'll describe that, parcel B, so on and so forth. In a grant deed that's recorded for the same property, they'll use that same legal description, parcel A, parcel B, so on and so forth, and refer back to the lot line adjustment document. Is that something that you guys will actually update a map from? Would you cut or split or do whatever on your maps per that legal description, or would you ask for another legal description that might be a little more definite? Everybody understand what I'm talking about?
Yeah, Riverside, we don't like to see that type if you got to pull the previous deeds that you're describing. So we try to help the title companies involved. We don't like them, so we like to see the reports. But it is a legal description. They're referring to another document.
Mm-hmm.
So if they really want to push it, we can go ahead and work it. So
right.
We really like to stay away from that and have them describe the actual 5 meets of house or whatever way.
We do too. And we'll write them a letter saying we need something a little more definite as far as the legal description goes. And trying to reference off of a lot line adjustment, it's tough. It's not really, even though it is a legal description on a document that was recorded, it's really tough to transfer property that way.
Anybody else have a comment on that?
In my county, we normally get an exhibit attached to.
Right.
And that's great, but that doesn't follow the paper trail in the future when you go to look at it. Like you said, it's just legal.
Right.
It's not there.
Right.
So, no, I agree with you.
And, you know, sometimes we'll get documents that it'll start off with parcel A of lot line adjustment such and such, but they'll also say that is also parcel 1 of parcel map such and such. So that's okay. We will go ahead and use that document because even though they said parcel A or parcel B of a lot line adjustment, they did go back and they did go ahead and say that this is also known as parcel 1 of a parcel map, but we'll go ahead and use it that way. But if it's just, you know, if they're just referring to lot line adjustments with that type of legal description, we won't cut the property. We'll send them a letter saying we need something a little bit more. So anybody else have any thoughts on that? So what's Don?
Pretty much like Doug, you don't like it, but you'll act on it.
Right.
And we don't see that too often because basically, we kind of send them an informative letter that says, our records are going to show this, and you may want to update that
story right,
for
your right.
future transactions.
Okay. Yeah, it was just like I said, something that we've been tossing back and forth with title companies and the surveyor's office. The surveyor's office is kind of on our side. It's not something that, you know, it's just so vague when you reference a lot of lines just falling down, so that's
yeah, it's good over Riverside. Our severe department taxes for that too. They definitely tell the surveyor that's going to bring that document in and say, we want an action strip.
Yes.
We'll bring it in. So when they're going through the lot line process, they make them put that in the lot line.
Right.
When it comes to recording, it's hard to take care of.
Because, you know, our surveyor is saying, well, you know, if they're going to use that type of description, what's the difference between that and them saying, well, you know, you go to the big rock and, you know, go this far from that, you know, east to the big oak tree, you know, same kind of thing. That's a legal description that, you know, it's very hard to follow. So, anyway, that's what I had. I was curious how some of the other counties use that, so. Okay, do you want me to tell a joke?
Well, we don't want to thank the secure on the
The certification. You went to the meeting, right?
Yeah.
The assessor's office? Okay. Or the assessor's conference? Right?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that.
I went to the Twin Assessors Conference in August up in Squawk, where they discussed our certification committee or certification proposal. Basically, they didn't like the way it stands. Most of them, I think, the majority agreed that they should be some type of test. Some of them even wanted to see some required training. But that wasn't the majority. I think so the very least I think we're going to have to do is try to come up with some type of text. So they can sign off on it. And I think they still even have trouble with the word certification. But it looks like we're back to the board.
Well, you know, I talked a little bit to my boss, and she was saying, well, you know, that does this have to do with, you know, more money? And, you know, we talked about this 10 years ago in San Diego when we first started talking about it. And yeah, more money would be nice, but just being recognized for what we do is the biggest part right there. And she really wasn't real excited about, you know, us being certified because, well, when you're looking for new people, and since all counties aren't, you know, since all counties aren't doing like automated mapping, you know, it's still a little bit of both. You know, she said that it would be hard to hire somebody. And, you know, are you looking for certification already? And of course, you're not, because you're not going to be certified unless you're already working in the assessor's office. So that would come later. But it's just, you know, some of the higher ups just aren't looking, you know, they're not real happy with
the way it's gone.
You've got more than one applicant. You've got one that is certified and others that are less experienced.
So it's like Randy said, we might have a little more work to do on this. And, you know, I was thinking about, I wonder how many other states have some type of mapping association. Has anybody heard of any other states having some type of association for assessor's office mappers?
New Mexico
does? Okay, because I found three other ones also that had that type of... They're looking more for GIS. One of them kind of was going along the lines of the IAAO kind of thing also, and I think that that's what the letter said from the Assessors Association, is modeling that test or whatever from that, you know, organization also. So
I do want to point out that they do support the idea of some type of recognition or certification, whatever they call it, for us. They just didn't like our proposed program at the time. So they are behind the idea of doing something, because they just come up with something that they agree with.
Right. Being on the certification committee, you know, I'll continue to work on this, and I think Doug was on the committee, Dan was on the committee, Wayne was on the committee, Emilio,
Steve,
and so we'll continue. Maybe we can't figure this thing out in the next few months. Jim, question?
Doesn't it seem like this calls for revisiting the idea of baseline job specifications?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, how do you know what to test?
Exactly.
And then there's the job itself, but then the GIS and CAD are like other tiers on top of that.
Right. And, you know, 10 years ago, like I said, when we first started talking about this, very few counties were any automated GIS mapping. Now that, you know, 10 years later, you know, we're neck deep in it now, so just have to figure out a little bit more to do with it. So.
And incidentally, the title organization is pursuing the very same thing at the very same time we are. But the assessors all seem to be in favor of both of them. So,
right.
In concept anyway.
Right.
Well, talking with my assessor, Riverside County, he wasn't against the certification. What he explained to me more is the testing part that we need to tie down. I think Jim's right. We need to find a baseline from there, either manual or AutoCAD or GIS, whatever is required to get a certified level. And I think we've got to go back and think about putting the test back on our website. And so that's the only way we're going to be able to get everybody in the state test. So I suggested that as the chief would have to sign on to this individual to take the test. So we can certify that person is that really take the test. We're going to have to develop something on the website to accommodate that type of testing.
I think the test would have to test for those skills that are common to every county, you know, that not software dependent.
Right. Throw in Mike to some sort of.
Sure.
From my perspective, what really should be looked at is the responsibility of how the particular unit handles the information, what it represents, and what you're supposed to do. CAD is very good. GIS is, you know, the dream one. But the reality is, you want to certify someone because they know what that information is and they know what it's supposed to do. CAD and GIS is a tool to an end. It's not the job itself.
Right.
But I think if you focus on, you want to certify people
because we want the best professionalism, and I think you would be able to build a case for a cost-benefit ratio. At the state, in our office, when I first started, we were using what's called the Delineator series. The Delineator is, a $2 word for that. The point of entry is drafting services. The minimum requirement was one course, equivalent to high school, in drafting, with the additional desirable qualification of graduation from high school. But it wasn't a requirement. We are now in the research analyst classifications that requires a four-year college degree with a minimum of 6 units in geography. If you move to an area where you're looking at a set of guidelines for certification, minimum qualifications to do the job of what you're doing, you're going to immediately start cutting out. You're going to do away with having to hire people because they're the low bidder. You know, they'll come and work for cheap because they may or may not have graduated from high school and meets that criteria. And when the question is, well, why certify? The answer is, why do the appraisers have certification? You know, it's that level of training, level of professionalism. You get better people who work more productively, therefore your cost is lower.
Right.
But the thing is, to focus on title transfer, deeds, all of that stuff, which is not handled by CAD or GIS.
That's a good look at it, Tim. Definitely.
One of the assessors, and I can't remember which county it was, asked, well, why couldn't we test based on age 215?
15 years old?
Yeah. No, we all know.
Oh, don't do it until I rewrite.
Well, that's basically what I told my boss, because I wasn't going to be there for that as part of the discussion. That's what I told him. It needs to be rewritten, and you wouldn't want to do any cuts on it until that happens. But the main thing is, at least they are behind the idea of what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, it's a matter of how we get there, how we're going to do it.
Right. Bill, do you have something else?
You asked other states to have some type of certification or designation. I look at Kansas, mm-hmm. Missouri, or Florida,
mm-hmm.
And kind of the way that comes about is, I believe, most of your assessor's offices, I believe they have other classes for other people in the assessment office. They've got like assessment 101 or something like that, don't they? That's kind of a general question. Does the state offer that? Like a general assessment class. If you're new to the office.
No, it's not offered, it's required.
Okay, required. So why not have something like that, but then have some math courses that you guys can take? Almost like electives that would be more oriented towards legal descriptions, cadastral mapping, and GIS. And also in the state of Illinois, they have something like that too. You have a basic certification called CIO. And then from there, you take 3 basic classes: property evaluation, introduction to basic assessment practices, and introduction to mass appraisal. And then you've got like 5 or 6 other classes that you can elect. And 2 of those are a mapping class and a legal descriptions class. So it gives you, if you're in the assessor's office, I would hope that you would want to have some understanding of the general operation of an assessment office, but then can kind of choose some electives to go in a certain direction, like that. Who's your thought?
Well, there's definitely different categories that you can break all the knowledge up into. Like interpreting legal descriptions, assessment practices, the mapping standards.
Well, this is definitely the farthest we've ever come.
Just on a kind of a different note, there's a likelihood that the people who are coming in to kind of replace people who have been doing this for a while are not going to get classified as drafters.
Right.
Like, I'm a systems engineer, right? And I work in the assessor's office, and I do cadastral mapping for the assessor's office in San Mateo County, but I don't have a historical kind of drafting type classification, so I don't know about that place.
I don't know if you're all aware right now, but the California Assessor Association has a committee to certify the title clerks that we have, transfer clerks. They're in the process of going through that. Maybe we could talk with their committee and see how they're looking to certify them and get some input from them.
Definitely something to look at.
From what I've been told, they're not even as far as we are. They're just kind of putting this out there like they want to be certified, and they're really in their beginning stages. The person I talked to made it sound like we were eons further than they are.
Well, we'll keep plugging away at it. I mean, you know, it's not something that we just, you know, want to get discouraged over. We'll keep trying that. So I think George had done a good job getting to this point with what he had written up. So
the letter that we got from the Chase Committee, I'm not sure, that's hanging up the appropriate on the website, or?
Yeah, that's the one.
All right, I'll have Jim post it on the website so I can read it.
If it's not already on there. I forget what I put on there.
I'm not sure if you did.
It's probably, I don't know if it ended up on the assessor's website or not, but, you know, like I said, my boss seemed to know about it. So
I think I might have put one of those pages of draft minutes or something that had that one paragraph.
Maybe.
But I don't know what that is.
Yeah, probably didn't have a whole letter on
this one. I don't think you have on it. Anything else anybody wants to, we're pretty much out of time, but is there anything else anybody wants to discuss? Any other questions?
I think you have a cadastral mapper list, is that correct?
Yes.
Is there any opportunity to have like a help page where we can all kind of like throw out what we're going through and have other counties answer how they're handling it? Is that something?
Jim, you want to answer that?
We have an email forum. All you do is contact me. I add you to the list, and then all you do is email a message to this particular email address. It's members@calmapping.org, and then that message will broadcast to everybody that's subscribed. It's like an email mailing list. That's basically what it is.
It might be having pages to do this to the website or to add this in, because a question could be asked, and, you know, 6 months or a year later, someone may, you know, well, I don't remember what that was, or I have another question, but all of the emails have been deleted. So rather than asking the question a second time, they could go to, you know, just on the website where everybody's
responses
are there.
Well, we looked at that early on when we first started the website. We thought, well, okay, there's two possible modes of communication. There's the email mailing list, and then there's the online forum.
Well, what I'm advocating is
that might be a good idea, but I think we figured at the time that typically people probably wouldn't tend to want to participate if it was just something they had to go to the website for. But I don't know.
Does that open up the possibility of retaining the information in the future? It opens up threads so you can have different people respond to their Facebook.
Yeah, that's the obvious
it's
benefit.
It's always there. You don't have to send out something to either and put something to respond to that stuff.
I don't see questions that maybe you don't even think to ask, but then all of a sudden once you read it, you go, oh, yeah. It
well,
something that I would like to be that,
yeah, and now we could do that, but from a web hosting point of view, I believe with the hosting plan we have now, a online forum feature may cost extra, which, and I don't know how much it would add, probably not a lot, maybe 15 or 20 bucks a year. But then that can snowball into something more because you get a limited amount of disk storage space on the web host also. And once you start storing things on it, your storage...
If we can solve 15 problems in a year, everybody, it's okay.
Well, that's true. And if that's something that the group feels we need at this point, then I say we go for it.
Yeah, so we can't afford it.
You have a question about that?
I set up an online forum for a group that I administer in my county, and it's much smaller than this group, but actually the commentary that I had was that with a forum software, if you're not using it, like thousands of people using it, it's so big and bulky and robust that everything is kind of locked down because people aren't responding. Like there's all these settings about like, oh, if you don't touch this post for X days, you block it out and it gets closed and put in the archive and stuff. So maybe like a blog environment, which is a little bit more active and ongoing, would be better and easier to use.
So what time do you think you're going to be able to make man?
I don't know.
I don't know. I just think that we pull over with other departments in different counties. I think it'd be good.
Yeah. Well, you know, what you're saying has a lot of merit. It was the option that when we set up the website at the time seemed like wasn't the one we needed at that time. We wanted participation. The email comes to you. You don't have to go out and find it. And so we thought that would at least get people to talking and communicating. And for the most part, it did. It worked.
If you're currently not signed up, contact Jim. Make sure you get signed up. And I think it's going to be it for today. We've got a reception at 5:30 in the room next door, Dollar's Bar. Anybody that's not going to the basketball game, I'll see you over there.
Yeah, I'll make sure I get this to you. See the phone. I don't think you have it on there.
Do what? Can you sign me up? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.